Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with an expert about safe gun storage. Jay will also have conversations about post-trauma parenting and the cost of pet parenthood. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Last year in Columbus, there were 124 homicides. 103 of those incidents involved guns. That's a staggering 83%, folks. Statewide, the numbers jumped to almost 2,000, and nationally, that number jumps to more than 50,000. Cassandra Kerfasi is the co-director of the Center for Gun Violence Solutions. The center's research focuses on a public health approach to the prevention of firearm injuries and violence, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. When was the Center for Gun Violence Solutions created, and what was its mission?
So we were formed as the Center for Gun Violence Solutions in 2022 through the merger of two longstanding organizations, one focused on research and one focused on advocacy, that had both been in place for about 30 years. The mission of our center is to reduce gun violence such that all people can live free from the scourge of gun violence. We are an academic center that pairs rigorous research with effective advocacy to promote and pass data-driven solutions to gun violence.
What is the most important thing that the everyday person can do to prevent gun violence?
Gun safety starts with safe gun storage. As a gun owner myself, I take pride in safely storing all my firearms because we have a responsibility as gun owners to make sure they don't fall into the wrong hands. As a researcher, I also know safe storage saves lives. It's essential that all of our guns are stored safely to make sure they're not causing harm in our homes or communities.
You know, when you say safe gun storage, and we think about all of the potential harm that could come from a weapon that is not safely stored with its safety on, most people think, okay, well, we're trying to prevent the kids from grabbing the gun, but it's not just the kids. It could be an argument between relatives, or it could be an accident involving a pet. Why is safe gun storage so very important?
Safe storage applies one of our principles of public health, which is separating in time and space the firearm from some potentially impulsive event during a crisis. So when we think about safe storage, we promote storing guns unloaded, locked up, and separate from ammunition. This ensures that kids and teens can't get unsupervised access. It also makes sure that should your home or car be broken into, that people can't steal those guns and use them to cause harm in our communities.
How do you know that your storage system is safe enough? How do you know that it works?
It's a really great question. There are a number of high-quality safes. Some are lockboxes. Some are gun safes. We also recommend gun safes that offer quick access features. Many gun owners own firearms for home defense and feel like they can't store them safely because they might need them in a crisis. But quick access safes that use biometrics or key codes allow you to store your gun safely and have it quickly in a time of crisis. And that safe storage is really important to save lives.
We did a story last week about two teenagers that were playing with what they thought were unloaded weapons in the one teenager's mother's basement, and one of the guns went off and fatally shot the other teenager in the torso. What advocacy do you promote to educate the parents that even an unloaded gun is not safe to play with?
You make such a good point. There's a common misperception that putting guns up is going to keep them away from kids. But one of the best things about kids and teens as well is their curiosity. If there's something to find, they're going to find it. And we see time and again, when they find guns, they're going to play with them or use them. And so it's really important that we are promoting and engaging in safe storage behaviors, which means storing guns unloaded, locked up, and separate from ammunition. Again, it can prevent unsupervised access or impulsive actions like violence or suicide.
Is there any data to show that Second Amendment rights enthusiasts are opposed to forced storage policies? Do they feel like it's a violation of their right to store it under their pillow at night?
While it might feel impossible to find things that people agree on these days, safe storage is actually an area of solid common ground. More than 70% of U.S. adults, including nearly two-thirds of gun owners, support requiring that people lock up their guns. Because with the right to gun ownership come important responsibilities, like the responsibility to store your gun safely to make sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
What do people who don't own firearms, where is their participation in this issue? Because oftentimes the victims are folks that don't have firearms at all. How can they advocate for their safety?
Everyone has a role in promoting safe storage, because even if you don't personally own guns, chances are you know someone who does. So have conversations with family members and friends about the importance of safe storage and how to store guns safely. When you send your kids on a play date, ask about guns in the home and safe storage the same way you would ask about other topics like bike helmets or food allergies. It's essential that we are storing every gun every time in the safest manner to make sure that they're not causing harm in our communities.
Is there a website where people can go to learn more about this topic and maybe learn how to even talk to their children about this issue?
Absolutely. We have a toolkit that we created for this month. It's available at t.jh.edu/safe-storage, or you can search for Safe Storage Saves Lives. It gives an overview of the research, talks about how guns should be stored, and it has important conversation starters to help ease these conversations.
All right. We want to thank Cassandra for being with us from Johns Hopkins, the Gun Violence Solutions Center, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Central Ohio has a population of over 2 million people. A substantial number of those people are parents, with as many as 25% of that group parents of school-age children. Now, every good parent wants to have a great relationship with their kids, one that's filled with joy, connection, and healthy attachment. But sometimes well-meaning but traumatized parents, those who suffered themselves as children and may be dealing with traumatic events as adults, tend to see the world from a survivalist point of view. Dr. Robin Koslowitz is a licensed child psychologist. She houses her practice at the Center for Psychological Growth of New Jersey, but she's also the author of the new book, Post-Traumatic Parenting, Break the Cycle and Become the Parent You Always Wanted to Be. She joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Not only is it a pleasure, but I have to tell you, being an amateur psychological kind of a guy, I loved every page of this book and how you approached such a very delicate and often overlooked subject.
Thank you. This book was really a labor of love. It was the book I would have needed to read when I became a mom 26 years ago, and there was just nothing on how do I stop my damage from damaging my kids.
And that was my first question, is what motivated you to tackle the subject? So I'm going to change that and say, how did you know you were damaged, and how did you know that was affecting your children?
Initially, when I was pregnant, I just thought, if it's so difficult for me to be inside this body with my panic attacks and flashbacks, it has to be bad for the developing baby. And, you know, I was a research geek, so I went to the stacks at Bopes Library at NYU, and I just looked for any research on that, and there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then it was like, how do you explain flashbacks to a toddler? how do I explain to my children why I zone out sometimes and why I sometimes have an exaggerated startle response? And there was just nothing anywhere that I could find on this topic. But the more I was researching it and the more I was just talking to people about it, whether it was, you know, parents at the hospital where I was working, whether it was colleagues, even, you know, somebody at the store, you know, I would say this and I would ask this question and people would say, oh yeah, that's me. I've always been wondering that too. And I got to hear so many stories of parents who all have this question. So it wasn't just, you know, my research. It was also just like, as we say in the world of research, it was my me search.
Yeah, you peeled back not only your onion, but a whole lot of other people's onions as well. So
yeah.
Let me ask you this. What do you mean when you use the phrase a survivalist point of view?
So when you are traumatized, your brain naturally creates what I call a trauma app. And that's your survival instinct on steroids. And the goal of the trauma app is to make you feel safe so that you can sort of go through life as if the world is safe. Because, of course, we're not safe. And if we went through life, you know, constantly checking if we were safe, like, you know, today I have to drive to do a book talk and it's several-hour drive, I am not going to crawl under my car and check the brake lines to see if anybody cut them, because I'm just going to have that illusion of safety that my car worked fine yesterday, it'll probably work fine today and probably tomorrow, right? I can't constantly go through life checking if everything is safe. So the trauma app does that. It restores this illusion of safety. So if you were raised in a home with a very angry dad, let's say, and you learned how to people please and always keep everybody calm, then that's going to be your go-to strategy anytime someone is stressed out, which might work great if you also have an angry boss. It might even work well in a romantic relationship. It's not going to be great for parenting, because if you people please your four-year-old, they're going to eat nothing but Fruity Pebbles. They're never going to wear shoes and they're never going to go to bed.
Right. So, my therapist, and yeah, I'm not ashamed to admit that I go to a therapist, and I think everybody else should, but that's my opinion. He liked to joke about Dr. Sigmund Freud, and he would do that voice. He'd say, "So, tell me about your relationship with your mother." When we think about our relationships with our mothers or fathers, for that matter, what role do parents play in the development of a child's long-term psyche and overall mental health?
So obviously, parents are very important. And, you know, Freud was definitely right about that. But for parenting, it's a little bit harder, because really our attachment system, which is the part of our brain that knows how to nurture a baby and make that baby feel safe and secure and soothed and seen, is really a copy-paste system. We sort of just do what our parents did. Our brain is primed. You know, Kahneman and Tversky showed that our brains are very efficient. They're primed to just copy-paste and do what's the easiest thing, which is copy. And if our parents were great, that's fine. But what if our parents weren't so great and we want to not do what they did? Or our parents parented us in such a different context that we can't copy it, because it was a different country. There was poverty. It was a dangerous situation. There was illness. And now we're parenting in a completely different context. Or now as parents, we want to provide that copy-paste system for our own children that they would want to replicate, right? That makes it very hard if we don't have one already.
Well, there's no such thing as a perfect childhood. I think we can all agree to that. But
sure,
even the best childhoods can leave scars. So what steps should parents take to not allow their traumas to impact their kids? How can they be mindful about that?
Our first job as parents is to say, let me prioritize this connection, let me prioritize this relationship. And then what ends up happening is, when we're raising our children, if we think about two things, and the entire part three of the book is about that, if we think about being responsive and responsible in our parenting, meaning we can be gentle and calm and help our kids understand their emotions, and at the same token, we also want to teach them how to behave, and we want to teach them how to take responsibility for their actions and navigate the world. As long as we're doing those two things, then we're doing a good job as parents. I think nowadays social media makes it sound like you either have to be a gentle parent and you have to go all the way crunchy granola, live on a farm, baby wear till they're four, sleep in the same bed at them till they're 15, I don't know, or you have to be extremely harsh and a real disciplinarian, and there's no choice in between. There's no reason we can't honor both sides. We can be gentle and responsive and responsible at the same time. If we're doing that, we're good.
I was at an event recently, and something happened that made me uncomfortable, and it leads to the next question. I witnessed a child who was no more than 10 or 11 years of age ask his mother, "Why are you treating me like this?" And she said, "Well, your grandmother did the same thing to me." Well, that grandmother was at that event, and she turned on the dime and said, "That never happened." And the woman said, "You're gaslighting me, and I don't appreciate it." So the question is, what is the family relationship dynamic like between Generation 1 and Generation 3 when the sandwich Generation 2 is the one that's been traumatized?
Yeah, I think that in that situation, clarity and communication is super important without giving the 10-year-old a job that isn't the 10-year-old's, right? This is between mom and grandma. They need to have a conversation about mom's childhood. And, you know, it's never too late to repair. It's never too late to say, you know, that wasn't my intent in how I parented you, but I understand that that was the impact. And to really have that conversation. And of course, you know, gaslighting is an interesting term because it implies a deliberate deception where you're trying to change reality in order to make the other person doubt their sanity. That either did or did not happen in that situation. But that's between mom and grandma. That's not for the 10-year-old. But mom needs to focus on her own healing so that she can parent the 10-year-old in a way where she doesn't want the 10-year-old one day to turn to her and say, why did you parent me in a way that hurt me, right? This could stop now. We can go from cycle breaking to cycle making in one generation, right? But the mom looking at the 10-year-old honestly and saying, I shouldn't be doing this to you, right?
Absolutely.
If this is a bad thing, I shouldn't be, you're right, I shouldn't slap you, or you're right, I shouldn't yell at you in public, whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with apologizing to a child if we did something wrong and taking responsibility for it.
And add to that, pausing to check your own behavior and be mindful of the impact that your behavior has not only on your child, but perhaps even on your parents.
Yes. Yes. It's also, none of that should be litigated in public, right? That's,
I love that you used the word litigated. That's perfect.
Yeah, all of these conversations can so easily be had in private. Like, this is the bread and butter of what therapists do sometimes, especially family therapists, right? Where we sit down and we have these mediation sessions, this hard conversation. It's hard for a mother to hear that her parenting didn't land well. It's hard for a child to say, to give that feedback. It's also hard for a child to hear the story that the parent was going through at the same time. But ultimately, that's where healing lies. If we can do that, then we reconcile, and then we repair. It's never too late to repair. I actually have someone who's a grandparent who's reading my book now. Even she's like, my kids are grown and flown, but I need to figure out how to fix it. I really regret some of the things that happened in their childhood. And she said, oh, it's too late for me. But it's never too late.
No, it's never too late. So the book, Post-Traumatic Parenting, Break the Cycle and Become the Parent You Always Wanted to Be, is available for purchase now. The author, Dr. Robin Koslowitz, has been our guest on Columbus Perspective. And if folks want to go to a website to learn more, what's the best URL to give them?
Posttraumaticparenting.com. That's where you can find my links and all the different socials that I'm on.
I got a funny feeling that this book is going to be, to this subject, what Ben Spock's first book was to parenting. It was brilliant.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate that.
For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
My roommate is a 35-pound miniature panther. Not really. He's just a large black cat. He has to have special food because of a potentially costly medical condition. His care is expensive. He doesn't work, even though he's been asked, so the expense is all on me. And I'm not alone. It's estimated that 2 of every 3 adults here in Columbus, Ohio, have at least one household pet, and some have more than one. Most people underestimate how much that costs. Renowned veterinarian and board-certified veterinary surgeon Dr. Courtney Campbell joins us on Columbus Perspective to share his latest health and wellness tips to keep our furry family, friends, and family members happy and healthy year-round, and also to talk a little bit about Synchrony's latest 2025 Pet Lifetime Care Study. How are you, sir?
I am absolutely fantastic. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And honestly, just hearing about your mini panther at home is making it put it in clear HD that you love your panther very much.
Oh, I do. I've been a cat guy since I was born. I've only had 5 years in my 57 years where I didn't have a cat, sometimes as many as 6, but now we're down to 1. And this is what our vet says, the largest domestic feline he's ever seen. And it's not a Maine Coon. It's just a big black cat.
Big black cat. Okay, when you say largest, we got to get a weight in there somewhere. How big are we talking?
The last time he went to the vet, he weighed in at 38 pounds.
That is definitely the largest cat I have ever heard of in my entire life. That's large. You basically have a mini labradoodle at home with a whiskers and a tail.
He is about the size of a medium dog. When he stretches out, he can almost cover the width of a king-size bed. I kid you not.
Unbelievable. Well, I'll tell you this, the fact that he can cover that king-size bed, I'm really keeping my fingers crossed that you never have to cover a king-size cost for any health care conditions. For him.
Well, that's absolutely right. And because he refuses to work, I've said, Shadow, you need a job. And he just growls at me and walks away.
Oh, my goodness. What a moocher.
Yep. So how much does it cost to have a dog per year as compared to a cat or maybe, you know, a gerbil, a fish, or a bird?
Well, the reality is this, is that we have some numbers, but the reality is that they are increasing. For example, it's estimated that over $61,000 is what you should sort of prepare for a lifetime of care for a dog, $48,000 for cats, and up to $15,000 for your small pocket pets, as we call them, which is, you know, your small mammals, your, you know, gerbils, hamsters, guinea pigs, those sorts of things. But here's the reality. This cost of care is evolving, and that pet parents out there are now seeing the intersection between the love and their multi-species family and then the financial reality of those costs. And fortunately, there are things that can be done to sort of bridge that gap.
Well, I will tell you that Shadow, earlier in his life, had a urinary tract blockage, and he had to have surgery, and the surgery cost over $1,500. There was no question that that money was going to be borrowed and that surgery would be paid for. But financial issues are sometimes hard to overcome for people who have pets, so they delay or they decline recommended treatments. What do we do?
Yeah, I mean, my heart goes out to you. Anytime you have urinary tract obstruction, as a surgeon, I see this far too common, particularly in male cats, because essentially, anatomically, it is really difficult for them to urinate, and so they get obstructed. Kudos to you for going ahead with that surgery, and now he's fine. But for a lot of pet parents, that is a cost that is severely stressful for them. Even anything above what at least the Synchrony's lifetime of care study indicates is any cost above $250. It creates financial stress. So, in my opinion, what I think is really important is that the Care Credit Card, according to the Synchrony Lifetime of Care study, indicates it does 3 specific things. Number 1, it gives access to care. So if you are experiencing, if you're in need of veterinary health care, it gives you access. 2, continuity of care. Maybe you could afford that initial cost of services, but now things are getting expensive and you can't continue. This bridges the gap. And then finally, emergencies. If you're confronted with a pet emergency, like you just talked about with Shadow, this now gives you that peace of mind that if I'm experiencing a pet emergency at home, I now have something that can give me, it can empower me to make the best decisions at the time.
Now, where does pet insurance play into this, doctor? Because I understand we're talking about a credit card that allows us to make payments over time, but where does pet insurance fall into this conversation?
Well, that's a great question, because if you look at the CareCredit credit card, you go, okay, that sounds really cool because it's a unique financial instrument. And pet insurance, that also is a unique financial instrument in that you're paying a certain amount per month for the peace of mind that if something was to happen, the insurance would kick in. The cool thing is that CareCredit credit card and pet insurance, they work together. It's called the Better Together campaign. So essentially, if you have a CareCredit credit card and you have pet insurance, then essentially, when you have to pay for services at the veterinarian, there's no out-of-pocket cost for you, and essentially the insurance reimburses your CareCredit credit card. So there are now options out there for pet parents just to create better access to care.
I remember, I have two grown children now, and I remember when we were planning to have kids, we did a financial cost analysis with our financial planner.
Genius.
I think that's something that should be done when it comes to pets, too, because of the expense. I mean, you said yourself, $61,000 for the lifetime of a dog, which, let's just say arbitrarily, that's 10 years. $6,100 a year could be more than a car payment.
Absolutely. It absolutely is more than a car payment. And let's just be honest, when it comes to having a species different family member or a multi-species family, the care and the love and the empathy for your pet, it far exceeds any car you might have. So this is about pet parents being confronted with the love and the empathy and the hope that they have with their pet, and then the stark financial reality. And sometimes those two, when they intersect, can be very stressful and it can be disheartening. But it doesn't have to be like that. With appropriate planning, just like what you said, and having some unique financial instruments, now we can empower pet parents to say, hey, listen, you can focus more on the love and focus more on the joy of being a pet parent versus the financial stress of, like, as you mentioned, potentially thousands of dollars a year.
Now, before I let you go, pro or con, do we cook for our pets or do we buy pre-prepared foods?
That's a great question. I would say there's nothing wrong with cooking for your pet, but just keep in mind, when you cook for your pet, there's not everything that your pet needs, so always incorporate some level of commercial diet so that your pet gets all the macro and micronutrients that they need.
All right, what about tap water versus bottled water or distilled water?
As long as your pet drinks it, any water is okay.
All right. Where can pet owners go to learn more about the Synchrony study and the CareCredit simplified reimbursement options that we talked about?
CareCredit.com. That's as simple as I can put it. But for those who are out there really enjoy the details of the study, it's just PetLifetimeOfCare2025.com. PetLifetimeOfCare2025.com. Otherwise, CareCredit.com.
Well, you know I'm going to read that study. Dr. Courtney Campbell, thank you so much for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have told me high property taxes is the number one complaint they hear from constituents. Many bills have been introduced to try to address the problem. The General Assembly passed several this year that Governor Mike DeWine then vetoed, saying the tax cuts would hurt schools and other public services. Now another attempt in triplet. State Representative Gary Click has introduced the Taxpayer Freedom Trilogy. It's a package of three bills he says is designed to restore transparency, accountability, and fairness to Ohio's property tax system. Basically, it would give taxpayers a louder voice on the taxes they are willing or not willing to pay. Here's how it breaks down. House Bill 420 would end continuing levies. These are tax levies that have been on the books for a long time. House Bill 421 allows citizens to vote on lowering inside millages if they think they are too high. Click says inside millages are taxes counties can raise without voter approval up to 10 mils. And House Bill 422 increases voter approval thresholds for new levies, so a higher percentage of voters would be needed to approve a tax increase. I caught up with Representative Click to dig into the Taxpayer Freedom Trilogy.
Where do property taxes stand on the list of topics that you hear about from your constituents?
I don't know if I can reach that high. That's the most important thing, the most frequent thing that we are hearing about right now in the legislature is property taxes. People, there's been just a surge in valuations, and that just means a spike in property taxes, and people are upset about it, and I don't blame them one bit.
So what is the idea behind your proposed trio of bills that you've dubbed the Taxpayers Freedom Trilogy?
Well, I've been doing a lot of listening, a lot of paying attention to what people are saying. And to me, these seem to be three simple aspects, things that we can do. And there's going to be pushback. There's pushback on both sides. And really, that's a lot of what we're facing right now as legislators. Is number one, we don't receive the property taxes and we don't assess the property taxes. We don't really have anything to do with that, but everyone's calling on us to solve it. Those who do assess property taxes don't want us to do anything. Those who pay property taxes want us to do everything. And I think there's a common sense middle ground, and that's what I'm trying to achieve with this trilogy of bills.
And the first one, I believe, would phase out permanent levies. Can you explain that?
Right. Well, we are paying taxes that our parents and our grandparents voted on and that were, you know, proposed and put in place by politicians that are long dead or at least no longer in office. And I believe that each generation has the right to speak and have a voice on the taxes that they pay. You know, the motto in the beginning was not no taxation, but it was no taxation without representation. And every generation has the right to representation in the taxes that they pay. So there should be, according to this bill, there will be no more permanent taxes, but they have to be renewed and they have to be revived in each generation.
And another step in this would allow voters to reduce what's called inside millage. Can you explain what inside millage is and why voters should have that right to approve?
Absolutely. That's a terrific question. Inside millage is taxes that are not voted on. It's property. You don't vote on it. The people who've been elected to represent you or appointed to represent you, they have up to 10 mils that they can just raise the taxes and set those tax rates for different things. And so what we're saying here is, okay, this is an opportunity for voters who say, you know, you're getting too much. And really, when there was this spike, some of these entities received a huge bonus and a boon in their income, and they didn't have to take it. But a lot of them said, well, we really need it, so we're going to take it anyway. And that really frustrates a lot of the taxpayers. So when that happens, the taxpayer, rather than just totally abolish the inside millage, which has been a thought, to say, okay, if the taxpayers are really motivated and they don't see the benefit, they can get a petition together, get 15% of the voters in the last election to come together and sign this petition and then turn that in and then put it on the ballot and vote to reduce that millage. It's not to eliminate it, although that could be the outcome, but they could just say, listen, the millage is too high. We're going to take it down a little bit. We're going to make it more reasonable.
And then the final phase in this trilogy is that, again, it's about voters really being involved, and that would be increasing, the percentage of the vote needed to raise a tax rate.
So we're trying to make taxes harder to raise and easier to decrease. And so with this, we're just saying, listen, the more you want, the higher the bar is to raise those taxes. And if you're asking for a little bit, the bar is not quite so high. But the more you ask for, the higher the standard is to achieve that. And that will help those taxing entities to really think about how much do we really need, how much do we really want, and what are the chances of us succeeding. And the higher the ask, the lower the chances of success are in new taxes.
The question then always comes back to, if these taxes are lowered or eliminated, then how do you replace them and make sure that key services aren't lost, such as police and fire?
You're exactly right, and that's why I think this is a middle ground. I know there's a lot of push, and I understand the passion to eliminate property taxes. People are upset. I would like to not pay taxes. I would also like to not pay for my internet. I'd also like to not pay for my mortgage. I would also really like to not pay my cell phone bill. There's a lot of bills I would like to not pay, but when I think about not paying them, what's the cost? What happens if I don't make my car payment? Well, there goes my car. And the same thing is going to happen if we eliminate property taxes. You know, I've had to call the fire department twice in my lifetime, once for a house fire that I was in, one for a house that was on fire that I can just look out my window right now and see this house that was on fire. And I'm sure glad that the fire department showed up. So we have to balance these things. And even when we go to the referendum, there's going to be a pro and a con on the ballot, 300 words for each to say, this is what happens. This is why we should reduce this. And then this is what happens if we do reduce it. And okay, you're going to lose your fire department, or you're not going to have EMS, or these types of things. So people understand what they're voting on. I totally understand the frustration of the voters. I'm the taxpayers, I'm with them. But I also want to make sure that we do things in a responsible fashion.
Yeah, there's that effort out there by a grassroots group to abolish property taxes across the state and put that on the ballot for folks to vote on next year. What do you think of that effort?
Well, I understand the passion that they have, but I always try to ask, you know, what's beyond the target? Okay, so if we do this, then what? And we want to make sure we consider. And even since I've been in the legislature, one of the things we try to pay most attention to is the unintended consequences. We don't want to do bad while we're doing good. And that can happen sometimes unintentionally. And I think that we need to think, okay, how are we going to cover these services? And so if you're going to do one thing in the same bill, you need to do the next thing. Unfortunately, some of them are saying to me, when I ask them those questions, they say, well, you're going to fix it. And the legislature will take care of it. And I'm thinking, really? So you don't trust us to do this, but when you make it worse, you're going to trust us to fix it. And they come up with some alternate things like sales tax, which really, when you think about it, you're going to have to quadruple, if not more, the sales tax. But what that does, especially on the edges of our state, it's going to drive people going across state lines to make their purchases, because it's just going to make financial sense for them. And it's going to hurt those local entities, those local subdivisions that have to maintain those services for their community. So the passion is real, and I don't blame them for the passion. I just don't think it's well thought out.
And Representative Click says the House may try to override more of the governor's property tax vetoes once the General Assembly's break ends in mid-September. A new bill introduced at the Ohio State House in this General Assembly would prohibit discrimination in public schools because of your hair. It's called the Crown Act. Crown stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. This proposal would apply to all hairstyles, including braids, locks, twists, and afros that are commonly associated with race. I say a new bill in this General Assembly because this is actually the fourth time the Crown Act has been introduced in the last 7 years. Bill's sponsor, State Representative Juanita Brent, says this is not just a cultural issue, it's an educational equity issue.
Fran Fraser founded Black Girl Rising, a Columbus nonprofit that gives black girls a voice. She says the girls often voice their feelings about their hair.
They're always having to deal with somebody saying something about how they wear their hair. And yes, they do talk about it a lot. And no, they don't like it.
Fraser supports the Crown Act. It would prohibit discrimination in Ohio public schools and preschools because of traits associated with race, including hair texture and styles.
I think what people of color have found out is that laws are probably the only way you get protected.
In June of 2024, the Ohio House passed the Crown Act with broad bipartisan support by a vote of 83-7. At that time, we talked with Jamie Blunt and her daughter Jay, now a high school senior in Gahanna. Jay said she has never experienced hair discrimination, but likes the bill.
A lot of girls that I know wear their hair to express themselves. And I feel like it's a good thing that black and brown girls can't express themselves like that.
But the bill did not advance in the Senate last year. So Democratic State Representative Juanita Brent is trying again, along with her Republican co-sponsor, State Representative Jamie Callender. They reintroduced the Crown Act earlier this month. Brent was not available for an interview Monday, but in a news release said, "No student should be punished or excluded from learning because of the way their hair naturally grows or how they choose to wear it to embrace their culture. The Crown Act affirms that every child in Ohio deserves to show up as their full self without facing bias or discipline because of their appearance." Frazier says black women have incredible hair that they can do many, many things with and look fabulous.
And so we have to have a law that says that we can do that and be proud of what we do with our hair. Then we need that law.
If the bill becomes law, a person could sue a school or preschool for discrimination over their hairstyle. The legislature is scheduled to get back to work in mid-September. We'll follow the Crown Act's progress as lawmakers consider it for a fourth time. Meantime, the city of Columbus passed its own version of the Crown Act in 2021.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.